Participants were members of a U.S. Peace Commission and representatives of the Comanche, Cheyenne, Arapaho, Kiowa, and Kiowa Apache tribes. The conference was the last great gathering of free Indians in the American West. The event was magnificent, surreal, doomed, absurd, and bizarre, and surely one of the greatest displays of pure Western pageantry ever seen. 9 newspapers sent correspondents to cover it. The council began, as many treaty meetings did, with each side making a great effort to impress the other. The U.S. Peace Commission, which included the Commissioner of Indian Affairs and William Tecumseh Sherman, the head of the Army in the West, arrived with an entourage so large that it required a wagon train and 15 or 20 ambulances to transport them. They were accompanied by a splendidly mounted guard of 500 soldiers in dress uniform, dragging their lethal, snub-nosed mountain howitzers behind them. The white men had brought with them a large quantity of gifts, too, and set up huge mobile kitchens to feed everyone. Soon after they arrived, they sent a rush order for additional supplies of 15,000 pounds of sugar, 6,000 pounds of coffee, 10,000 pounds of hard bread, and 3,000 pounds of tobacco. There were an estimated 4,000 Indians in attendance, which included 100 Comanche lodges. Once the soldiers had drawn up before the Indian camp, something extraordinary happened. It was described by Alfred A. Taylor, later the governor of Tennessee, who covered the council as a reporter, as follows. By this time, thousands of mounted warriors could be seen concentrating and forming themselves into a wedge-shaped mass, the edge of the wedge pointing toward us. In this sort of mass formation, with all their war paraphernalia, their horses striped with war paint, the riders bedecked with war bonnets, and their faces painted red, came charging in full speed toward our columns. When within a mile of the head of our procession, the wedge, without hitch or break, quickly threw itself into the shape of a huge ring, or wheel without hub or spokes, whose rim consisted of 5 distinct lines of these wild, untutored, yet inimitable horsemen. This ring, winding around and around, with the regularity and precision of fresh-oiled machinery, approached nearer and nearer to us with every revolution. Reaching within 100 yards of us at breakneck speed, the giant wheel or ring ceased to turn and suddenly came to a standstill. This maneuver was enormously impressive to the white people, not least because it amounted to a test of faith. The giant spinning wheels within wheels formation was a trademark of plains warfare, and the sight of it whirling ever closer would have been eerily familiar to the soldiers who sat their horses in that long parade line. There was also a hint of sadness in all of this martial pomp and circumstance, and many who were there sensed it. The very purpose of the council was to end once and for all this sort of behavior, or to render it meaningless and ceremonial. Such an exhibition, indeed, would only be witnessed a few more times before it passed forever into myth and history and phonied-up traveling shows like Buffalo Bill's. The council opened with a ritual smoking of the peace pipe, and then the commissioners began the proceedings with a good old-fashioned scolding of the assembled horse tribes. The Indians were reminded that, in shameful violation of their treaties, they had been making war on whites. Said Senator John B. Henderson, chairman of the Committee on Indian Affairs, "This made the hearts of our people very sad." He did note that we are greatly rejoiced to see our red brethren so well disposed toward peace. What the Great Father wanted, he patiently explained, as though to children, was to give the Indians their own lands away from the white settlements. They would be given tools and seeds. They would be taught how to farm. A carpenter would show them how to build houses. Schools would be built for them to teach them to read. And while they learned these things, the Great Father would also provide $25,000 worth of clothing and other necessary items every year for 30 years. In exchange, the Indians had to cease all hostilities, reside on the lands provided, and promise not to interfere with white roads, rails, forts, or other development. The Indians were invited to tell their side of the story, which they were eager to do. The first speaker, Kiowa Chief Satanta, set the tone for what was to follow. He began by rubbing sand over his hands. He shook hands with the participants in the council circle, then proceeded to tell them that he wanted nothing to do with the white man's notion of peace. He said, "This building homes for us is all nonsense. We don't want you to build any for us. We would all die. Look at the Panaticas. Formerly, they were powerful, but now they are weak and poor. I want all my land, even from the Arkansas south to the Red River. My country is small enough already. If you build us houses, the land will be smaller. Why do you insist on this? What good can come of it?" Speaking next for the Comanches was Panatica Chief Tosawa, Silver Brooch, who knew a great deal about what happened to horse Indians on the reservation. Speaking in what one observer described as a calm, argumentative voice, he delivered a blunt condemnation of the plan. A long time ago, the Panatica Comanches were the strongest band in the nation. The Great Father sent a big chief down to us and promised medicines, houses, and many other things. A great, great many years have gone by, but those things have never come. My band is dwindling away fast. My young men are a scoff and a byword among the other nations. I shall wait till next spring to see if these things shall be given to us. If they are not, I and my young men will return to our wild brothers to live on the prairie." The most impressive address of all, indeed it was a showstopper, came from Ten Bears, the aging Yamparica chief who had battled Kit Carson at Adobe Walls, who gave one of the most eloquent speeches ever made by an American Indian. In its extraordinary evocation of violence, beauty, suffering, and loss, Ten Bears' words astounded the white participants for whom it was translated. Among his topics, he described his reactions to the 1864 fight, offering a perspective that would have amazed his adversaries, who tended to believe that Indians did not have the same sort of feelings as they did. Before he began his speech, he put on a pair of wire-rimmed spectacles, which made him look strangely bookish, though he was illiterate. "My heart is filled with joy when I see you here," he began. "As the brooks fill with water when the snows melt in the spring, and I feel glad as the ponies do when the fresh grass starts in the beginning of the year. My people have never first drawn a bow or fired a gun against the whites. There has been trouble between us. My young men have danced the war dance, but it was not begun by us. It was you who sent out the first soldier. 2 years ago, I came upon this road, following the buffalo, that my wives and children might have their cheeks plump and their bodies warm. But the soldiers fired on us. So it was upon the Canadian. Nor have we been made to cry once alone. The blue-dressed soldiers and the Utes came out from the night. And for campfires, they lit our lodges. Instead of hunting game, they killed my braves, and the warriors of the tribe cut short their hair for the dead. So it was in Texas. They made sorrow in our camps, and we went out like the buffalo bulls when the cows are attacked. When we found them, we killed them, and their scalps hang in our lodges. The Comanches are not weak and blind, like the pups of a dog when seven sleeps old. They are strong and far-sighted, like grown horses. We took their road, and we went on it. The white women cried, and our women laughed. But there are things which you have said to me which I do not like. They were not sweet like sugar, but bitter like gourds. You have said that you want to put us on a reservation, to build us houses and make us medicine lodges. I do not want them. I was born under the prairie, where the wind blew free, and there was nothing to break the light of the sun. I was born where there were no enclosures, and everything drew a free breath. I want to die there, and not within walls. I know every stream and wood between the Rio Grande and the Arkansas. I have hunted and lived over that country. I live like my fathers before me, and like them, I lived happily. When I was in Washington, the Great Father told me that all the Comanche land was ours and that no one could hinder us in living upon it. So why do you ask us to leave the rivers and the sun and the wind and live in houses? Do not ask us to give up the buffalo for the sheep. The young men have heard talk of this, and it has made them sad and angry. Do not speak of it more. I love to carry out the talk I get from the Great Father. When I get goods and presents, I and my people feel glad, since it shows that he holds us in his eye. If the Texans had kept out of my country, there might have been peace. But that which you now say we must live in is too small. The Texans have taken away the places where the grass grew the thickest and the timber was best. Had we kept that, we might have done the things you ask. But it is too late. The whites have the country which we loved, and we wish only to wander on the prairie till we die. It was even too late for that, as the Indians knew better than anyone. No free Indians were going to be allowed to wander anywhere. Ten Bears's soaring rhetoric was elegiac at best. He did not really think the whites were going to offer him anything better than they already had. Though Medicine Lodge was ostensibly a bargaining session, in fact, there was no bargaining at all. The whites were issuing a thinly disguised ultimatum. General Sherman, who had participated in the conference as a peace commissioner, but actually advocated military operations against delinquent tribes, offered them no comfort or consolation. It was clear to him, though perhaps not yet to the vast herd of public policymakers in Washington, that the old solutions no longer applied. The Indians could not be driven away or removed to the West. That had been the old solution, the one employed with the Creeks, Seminoles, Delawares, Iroquois, and other Eastern tribes. The Plains Indians resided in the heart of the last frontier, and their land was not simply wanted as a pass-through for trains and wagons heading west. Comancheria itself was coveted by white men. Sherman told the Indians they would have to give up their old ways and learn to become farmers. And there was nothing, they were told bluntly by the man who had overseen carnage on a scale that these Indians could not possibly comprehend, they could do about it. "You can no more stop this than you can stop the sun or the moon," he said. "You must submit and do the best you can." And so they did, signing what amounted to a gigantic abstraction that was based on notions of property, on cartography and Western migration, and on the larger idea of manifest destiny, none of which they would ever completely comprehend. The white man would drag his treaty back to the Great Father, where it would sit among the forests of granite and marble, and somehow work its terrible, invisible magic. The Indians were not in any way happy about what they were being asked to do. There was nothing good about it, nothing but destruction and degradation on their end, though to most of them it seemed far better to mollify the white man yet again with a treaty, especially one that came with gifts attached, than to refuse and thus unleash warmongers like Sherman. On October 21, 1867, chiefs from all of the tribes put their marks on the treaty, which of course they could not read. They included headmen from the Yamparica, Ten Bears, Painted Lips, Here's a Wolf, Little Horn, Dog Fat, and Iron Mountain, the Nokonis, Horseback, Gap in the Woods, and Penaticas, Silver Brooch, Standing Feather. As much as a third of the tribe was not represented at the council. Mostly they were Kotsotakas and Quahadis, the two most remote bands who tended to camp together in the Llano Estacado. The Kotsotakas had signed a treaty in 1865, though they never had abided by it. The Quahadis had never signed anything, and never would. That did not matter to the U.S. Peace Commission. The entire tribe was presumed to have signed the agreement, and they would all be held to it. The band structure of the Comanches no longer mattered to anyone. Among the unreconstructed elements of the Quahadis who were present at Medicine Lodge was the 18-year-old Quanah. Why he should have been there is unknown. Quanah's own description sounds quite casual. He had been on the warpath against the Navajo, he said. While staying at a Cheyenne village, he was told that white soldiers were coming to a great powwow and bringing beeves, sugar, and coffee. I went and heard it, Quanah said later. There were many soldiers there. The council was an unusual one. A great many rose. The soldier chief said, here are two propositions. You can live on the Arkansas and fight, or move down to the Wichita Mountains, and I will help you. But you must remember one thing and hold fast to it, and that is you must stop going on the warpath. Which one will you choose? All the chiefs decided to move down here, to the reservation. For anyone who believed that the Indians were sincere in signing the Medicine Lodge Treaty, its implications would have seemed breathtaking. The treaty required nothing less than that the great and unrivaled powers of the Middle and Southern Plains move immediately and en masse to reservations and take up modest new lives, accepting agencies, schools and farms, government teachers, blacksmiths, carpenters, and agricultural instructors, all of which they had said specifically and repeatedly that they did not want. They were allowed to leave the reservation to hunt south of the Arkansas. But the treaty really meant that they would have to cease fighting and stop following the buffalo, which in turn meant that they would have to cease being Plains Indians. They would have to reorder their entire social structure around a set of values and principles that were still largely unimaginable to them. The Comanches and Kiowas were to share a 2.9 million acre reservation in what is now southwestern Oklahoma, north and east of the Red River and its North Fork, south of the Washita, and west of the 98th Meridian. This was actually very good land, huntable and arable, and with decent water sources, and it was in traditional Comanche territory and included Medicine Bluffs and other sacred sites. But it was a tiny fraction of Comancheria, which at its peak held nearly 200 million acres. Nor did it include by far the richest of the old hunting grounds, the Texas Bison Plains. The Cheyennes and Arapahoes, meanwhile, only their southern bands, agreed to live on a reservation immediately to the north of the Comanche Reservation. Seen from the distance of a century and a half, the Medicine Lodge Treaty can seem like a cynical document. But it did not at the time appear that way to lawmakers in the East, or to the members of the Peace Commission who signed it. Their efforts had inspired great hope that this would offer a final solution to the Indian problem on the southern plains. This belief was held despite the Indians' stern protestations and the deep skepticism of the army in the West. After all, the eastern Indians had made the transition to farming life. The civilized tribes, after the horrendous attrition of the Trail of Tears, had managed to change. So could the Plains Indians. To many people, the treaty seemed a fair and reasonable solution to an old and intractable problem. They were mistaken. Instead, Medicine Lodge provided the framework for the last great betrayal of the Indians by a government that had betrayed and lied to Native American tribes more times than anyone could possibly count. The agent of the betrayal was the Office of Indian Affairs, one of the most corrupt, venal, and incompetent government agencies in American history. The new era began with the bizarre decision by J.H. Leavenworth, the appointed agent for the Comanches and Kiowas and a loud proponent of peace, to locate his agency at Fort Cobb on the Washita River, which was on the reservation of the Wichitas and affiliated bands well north of the Comanche-Kiowa lands. Leavenworth's ill-considered decision introduced warlike mounted Comanches into direct proximity with Indians who farmed and lived in houses. As the Civil War years had shown with cruel clarity, this was a very bad idea. The error was compounded when several thousand Kiowas and Comanches actually showed up at the agency in the winter of 1867-68, precisely what Leavenworth and his bosses wanted. But for some reason, they had failed to anticipate that these Indians would need food. Shockingly, Medicine Lodge had not provided for Indian rations, and so the government had nothing to give them. Nor did it have any of the promised annuity goods, and would not until Congress ratified the treaty in the summer of 1868. Leavenworth himself was not to blame, but collectively, the white men had made an unforgivable blunder which meant a crushing failure of the very first post-treaty test of friendship and sincerity. The Indians were disgusted and furious. They believed the white men had lied to them. They were also hungry because it was winter, and they had counted on the government food to help them get through the hard season. Leavenworth tried desperately to compensate, issuing all the goods in his possession, using his breeding cattle for food, and even buying goods with unauthorized credit. But those moves were not sufficient to feed the miserable and restive Comanches. So they began to solve their problem the old way, by raiding the Wichitas and other nearby tribes. They stole cattle, horses, and mules, and if anyone got in their way, he was killed and scalped. At one point, the raids got so bad that the sedentary tribes were forced to stop farming altogether so they could guard their horses, mules, and cattle. The food crisis was made worse by yet another remarkably short-sighted decision. The Office of Indian Affairs, in its ardor for peace and in its fundamental belief that these Indians were always gentle unless provoked by white men, had prohibited the stationing of troops at the agency. This was yet another catastrophic mistake, which not only gave the Comanches a free hand to ravage the Indian country, but it also gave them a secure base from which to conduct their ever more frequent raids into Texas. Leavenworth, who had strongly supported the peace plan, was soon complaining bitterly. "I recommend that the Kiowa's annuities, as well as the Comanches, be stopped and all confiscated for the benefit of the orphans they have made. The guilty are demanded, according to our treaties, for punishment, and if not delivered up, then let them be turned over to the military to make short, sharp work with them." Thus disabused of his old idealism, Leavenworth now had to contend with 1,000 surly, disappointed Comanches who were back to their old habits of raiding and stealing and committing atrocities. Unable to bear the strain, he simply walked off his job in the spring of 1868. From May to October, one of the most critical times in the history of relations between Plains Indians and the U.S. government, there was no federal authority at all in the Comanche-Kiowa reservation. Traders and other white men had fled in fear of their lives. The property custodian, the only white person who remained at the agency, could do nothing but keep track of the continuing raids into Texas and to count the number of scalps the raiders brought back. It was pure chaos, pure anarchy. When the goods finally did arrive, they were of abysmal quality. And now the Indians confronted yet another aspect of the Indian office, its corruption. The clothing the Indians had been promised was shoddy and threadbare. The pants all came in one size, large enough to fit a 200-pound man. Few Comanches weighed that much. The hats they received looked like those worn by the Pilgrims. Most of the Comanches ripped the clothes up and used them for other purposes. The food was bad, too. Instead of fresh meat, which had always been their diet, they got rancid bacon or salt pork. They were given a lot of cornmeal, which they detested, and fed to their horses. None of these failures could be blamed on the tangled government bureaucracy. They were the product of the endemic corruption and graft for which the Indian Office had justly become infamous by the 1860s. The Indian Peace Commission of 1867 had been so scandalized by what they found out in the various agencies that they wrote, "The records are abundant to show that agents have pocketed the funds appropriated by the government and driven the Indian to starvation. It cannot be doubted that Indian wars have originated from this cause. For a long time, these officers have been selected from partisan ranks, not so much on account of honesty and qualification as for devotion to party interests and their willingness to apply the money of the Indian to promote the selfish schemes of local politicians." As time went by, the agents proved stupid as well as corrupt. Ironically, one commodity they were actually proficient at delivering to Comanches and Kiowas was weapons. The Indians had made an eloquent plea for better rifles. Without them, they could not hunt effectively, they argued, and thus would be more dependent on the government. While this argument had some merit, it was also quite as obviously true that Comanches were attacking Texas homesteads and Wichita farms. Amazingly, the Indian office persuaded the Department of the Interior, in violation of laws against arming Indians, to deliver several tons of arms and ammunition to Plains tribes, including Comanches. And these weapons were not shoddy at all. In a day when the standard Army-issue weapon was still the single-shot rifle, the Indian weapons included repeating Spencer and Henry rifles and carbines. The heart of the Medicine Lodge Treaty, the plan to turn Comanches and other horse tribes from nomadic hunter-gatherers into house-dwelling farmers, meanwhile, was also proving almost completely futile. A few Penaticas, long in captivity, tried to go along with the idea. But in general, Comanche men simply refused to have anything to do with farming. When Leavenworth hired a white farmer in the spring of 1868 to demonstrate the planting of seeds, Comanches swooped down and plundered the fields before the crop was ripe. They ate green watermelons, which made them violently ill and confirmed their belief that agriculture was bad medicine. The Indians only wanted beef, and eventually forced the agent to spend most of the budget on it, leaving little or nothing available to buy seed and farming tools. The result of such efforts was to convince most Comanches that they were better off outside the reservation. On June 30, 1869, it was estimated that there were 916 Comanches on the reservation, but none of them were self-supporting farmers. All were living in teepees and subsisting on a combination of their own hunting, the undependable government food and annuities, and raids on Texas and on other tribal reserves. Many drifted off the government land to join the hostile bands in the Llano Estacado. There developed a pattern. In winter, more Comanches would arrive to camp on the reservation and to claim beeves and other food and annuity goods. In the spring, they would drift back to the Buffalo Plains again or join raiding parties headed for the Texas frontier. It was a confusing, highly fluid situation. The one certainty was that, in spite of considerable government effort, Comanches remained Comanches. They had not yet been broken of their old habits. Such a situation could not endure. The first casualty was the hated Office of Indian Affairs itself, which was destroyed by its own greed and incompetence. In 1869, Congress abolished it. In its place was put the Indian Bureau, which had joint supervision with the Interior Department over Indian affairs and appropriations. President Ulysses S. Grant wanted the Army to run the individual Indian agencies, as it had long wanted to do. But the Army as villain image persisted, and Congress refused to go along with Grant, voting for what seemed at the time like an ingenious compromise. The agencies would be run by nominees from various Christian denominations, thus minimizing the corruption. And if the Indians were converted to Christianity, so much the better. This became known as Grant's peace policy. One of the supreme ironies of Western history is that the denomination chosen to look after the most warlike tribe in history was the gentlest and most militantly peaceful religious sect in the nation, the Quakers. If Grant, who appointed them, appreciated the humor, he never mentioned it. 16. The Anti-Custer. Ranald Slidell McKenzie came from one of those prodigiously overachieving eastern seaboard families that seemed connected, in profound and unaccountable ways, to everyone who was anyone in the corridors of power. His grandfather, John Slidell, was a Manhattan bank president and political power broker in New York City. His uncle, John Jr., became the most powerful man in Louisiana politics, a U.S. senator, and the top advisor to President James Buchanan. McKenzie's Aunt Jane married Commodore Matthew Perry, the man who opened Japan to the West. Aunt Julia married a rear admiral. Uncle Thomas became Chief Justice of Louisiana. His father, Alexander McKenzie Slidell, who reversed his last and middle names at the request of a maternal uncle, was both a prominent naval commander and a well-known writer of histories and travel books, who once had the distinction of being court-martialed for hanging the son of the Secretary of War for mutiny. His mother came from splendid bloodlines, too. Her grandfather had been Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Alexander Hamilton. Mackenzie thus grew up in elevated society, though his father's death when he was 8 put the family in more or less permanent financial difficulty. He was a frail, shy, smallish, unhealthy boy with the pale skin and transparent eyes of his Scottish forebears and a speech impediment that some described as a lisp and others as a slight stutter. He attended Williams College in Massachusetts, hoping to be a lawyer, but the family's straitened finances would not allow him to finish. After 2 years, he arranged for a transfer to West Point, which paid a salary in addition to providing free education. He matriculated there in 1858. Against all of his family's expectations, he performed brilliantly, graduating first in his class of 28 cadets. He was considered by many in his class to be the all-round ablest man in it. He never grew much. As an adult, he was a slim 5 feet 9 inches tall, the limit for a cavalryman, but he lost some of his shyness, made friends more easily, played pranks, and ran with a lively crowd. His talent in mathematics secured him a position as assistant professor while he was still a student. In the tiny, cloistered world of the military academy, he undoubtedly knew the immodest and trouble-prone young man, one class ahead of him, named George Custer, though there are no records of their relationship. The two officers could not have been more different. Custer was exuberant, vainglorious, and outrageous. Mackenzie was dark and complex, deeply private and inwardly turned, and never built for public adulation. Custer was a horrendous student, and the word able was not the first that came to mind when people described him, more like libidinous and alcoholic. When he graduated in 1861, he ranked 34th out of 34 students in his class, having accumulated a class-high 726 demerits. In spite of these gaping differences, the two men were, oddly, twins of fate. Born less than a year apart, their careers mirrored each other virtually every step of the way, from their money-strangled ambitions to study law, to their West Point days, to their heroism and precociousness in the Civil War, where they fought in the same campaigns, and ultimately to their Indian fights in the West. The parallel lines crossed only a few times, last occurring after the disaster at Little Bighorn, where Mackenzie was sent north to, in effect, clean up Custer's mess. Mackenzie's graduation in 1862 landed him in the middle of the Civil War, and over the next 3 years, he climbed the ranks with breathtaking speed. He served in the Engineer Corps at the battles of Manassas, 2nd, Fredericksburg, Chancellorsville, and Gettysburg, receiving brevet promotions that quickly boosted him to the rank of major. A brevet rank was temporary, often given on the battlefield to increase the officer corps in times of emergency. The idea was to keep the Army from becoming, in peacetime, top-heavy with officers. Still, he was bored by engineering work and longed for command. He finally got it at the Battle of Cold Harbor in June 1864, when he was breveted to lieutenant colonel and given charge of the 2nd Connecticut Volunteer Artillery. He was 23 years old. He soon proved himself to be both dazzlingly competent and almost recklessly brave. At the Battle of Winchester, where Custer also fought, he seemed to court destruction all day long, wrote one of his soldiers. With his hat held aloft on the point of his saber, he galloped over the 40-acre field through a perfect hailstorm of rebel lead and iron with as much impunity as though he had been a ghost. At one point, a Confederate artillery shell cut the horse he was riding in half. Wounded in the thigh, he bound the gash up and kept on fighting. With just a few months left in the war, he was given his first major command, the Cavalry Division of the Army of the James. By Appomattox, he held the brevet ranks of Brigadier General of the Regular Army and Major General of the Volunteers, making him the highest-ranking officer in West Point's class of 1862. He was only 24 years old. He had been breveted 7 times in less than 3 years, a pace of promotion almost unheard of in the Army, and which beat Custer's 5 brevets, though Custer ended with the same rank. Mackenzie was, moreover, one of Grant's favorites. I regarded Mackenzie as the most promising young officer in the Army, Grant later wrote in his memoirs. Graduating at West Point, as he did, during the second year of the war, he had won his way up to command of a corps before its close. This he did upon his own merit and without influence. Something else happened to Mackenzie during the war. Like so many other young men, he hardened. He lost his easy affability, his prankishness, and much of his good humor. This was undoubtedly caused in part by the bloodshed and suffering he witnessed from 1862 to 1865, but it was more directly related to a series of gruesome, debilitating wounds he received, and from which he would never fully recover. He was wounded on 6 different occasions. At Manassas, he was shot with a 50-plus caliber bullet through both shoulders, a terrible internal wound that should have killed him. He lay where he fell for 24 hours before being rescued. He was hit in the leg with an artillery shell at Winchester and later wounded in the chest by shrapnel. Another artillery shell took off the first 2 fingers of his right hand. The pain never left him, and it changed him. His first command felt the brunt of this change. When he inherited it, the 2nd Connecticut had been a beaten, neglected, and demoralized unit. After Cold Harbor, Mackenzie drilled them mercilessly and punished them liberally. The men hated him. He was so hard on them that some even plotted to shoot him in the next battle. "By the time we reached the Shenandoah Valley," wrote one of his lieutenants, "he had so far developed as to be a greater terror to both officers and men than Early's grape and canister." At Winchester, the regiment fought brilliantly. Its losses were higher than any other regiment in the fight. The men also witnessed Mackenzie's astounding bravery. After that, the talk of mutiny stopped. His men did not like him, many feared him. But like all men in subsequent Mackenzie commands, they always believed they had a better chance with him in battle than with other commanders. He was not what West Pointers would describe as a martinet. He was neither vain nor arrogant nor capricious. He was just brutally demanding, the boss from hell. After the war was over, Mackenzie remained in the Army, reverting to his actual rank of captain, as did Custer, and building harbor defenses in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. In 1867, he was promoted to colonel and took command of the 41st Infantry, a black regiment that soon moved to Texas. He was stationed at various different forts there and saw his first limited Indian engagements in 1869 and 1870. They were really nothing more than skirmishes. He spent a good deal of his time sitting on courts-martial in San Antonio. In 1871, he got his big break. He was given command of the 4th Cavalry on the frontier, an event that was a direct consequence of President Grant's increasing impatience with the peace policy. It was no accident that the man he considered his most aggressive and effective officer was being placed squarely in the path of Comanche war parties.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.